Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, we're very interested in Dolly Madison here at YWC and also, of course, at Montpelier. And we've spent several episodes talking about her in various guises and the various phases of her life. But there's one phase of her life that we've never really explored. And that's why we call this episode Dolly Before She Was a Madison. I was out at Montpelier recently and I was talking to my good buddy Lynn Uzel, who's the resident scholar at Montpelier and who's also the resident interpreter of Dolly Madison. And it turned out we'd been thinking along the same lines and that she had just recently visited Philadelphia, the city where Dolly Madison spent her young adulthood. And she had just done some very extensive research. She'd set up a website about Dolly Madison's life in Philadelphia. Who knew? I didn't know. But I had independently gone to Philadelphia and I'd visited some of the very same places. I'd visited, for example, Todd House. Todd was the name of Dolly Madison's first husband, and the house where they lived is preserved in Philadelphia, and I visited there. And in fact, a little later on, I'm going to speak with Carrie D. Thorne, who is works for the National Park Service as a historian, and she took me through there. But the first part of our episode today, I'm going to talk to Lynn Uzel, and she's going to tell me the whole story of Dolly Madison's early life. So, Lynn Uzel, welcome back to your weekly constitutional.
It's a pleasure to be here, as always, Stuart.
Tremendous. Now, I understand you are going to tell us something very interesting about Dolly Madison that we haven't discussed before. What is that?
Well, I thought today we would talk about Dolly Madison in Philadelphia.
Dolly before she was a Madison.
Exactly.
When she was a Payne.
She
I'm sorry, I just got that. No pun intended. She was a Payne, and then she was a Todd.
She was a Payne Todd.
A Payne Todd.
Yes.
There we are. Okay, well, let's start at the beginning. Tell me about her times in Philadelphia.
All right. Well, I think for the first thing that we should mention is that the reason her family moved to Philadelphia is very interesting. Her father was...
Well, let's actually start at the beginning. She was born in North Carolina.
Right.
She spent basically her whole youth in Virginia.
That's correct.
Okay, now, what?
And she is about 15 years old, and her father is a zealous convert to Quakerism, to the Society of Friends. Mm-hmm. And the Quakers are becoming increasingly more anti-slavery. And her father, John Payne, was among the foremost who encouraged the flock to free their slaves, even though it was not yet legal to do so in Virginia. A lot of the congregation freed them informally, even though it was not legal to do so. And then when Virginia passed a law making it legal to manumit one's slaves, then he formally freed his slaves in 1783. And because he felt he could not maintain the family economically as a planter in Virginia without slaves, he moved the whole family to Philadelphia.
You know, that's a remarkable statement. First of all, manumission is that fancy legal term for freeing a slave that you used a moment ago. But that, you know, people don't realize that if you owned slaves, they were likely the single biggest asset you owned. And so his decision to free his slaves was an act of a great deal of economic sacrifice. I mean, he was putting his money where his mouth was.
Right. And you're absolutely right. A lot of people do not realize how much of a sacrifice it was. I mean, they look at those Virginians who claim to be opposed to slavery, but they had slaves, and they question, well, were they hypocrites? But the fact is that freeing your slaves meant an enormous economic hit immediately to the household wealth.
Right, it's like giving away half your house.
Exactly.
Or your cars or, you know, any other major asset. Now, I'm not defending slavery or anything of that sort, but I'm just saying it wasn't nearly as easy as it looks 200 years hence.
You're absolutely right. Some have estimated that something like 56% of the wealth in the South was tied up in slavery.
Wow.
So to free your slaves is, first of all, to divest yourself of a lot of that wealth. And then secondly, there's a large question as to whether or not you can survive economically in the South, where, as many people have put it, labor is so cheap.
It's devalued. Because
right.
Free laborers, I mean, that's an often overlooked cost of slavery. Mm-hmm. People who are poor and have nothing to sell but their labor, the value of their labor is much lower because of slavery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened the next generation. Dolly's brother, also named John Payne, lived near Montpelier. And after James Madison died, he decided that he could no longer make a viable living in Virginia because he did not own slaves, and moved the family up north, asked advice of his cousin. Dolly's cousin had also done the same thing. Had Edward Coles had freed his slaves and moved north, and again because they felt they could not make a living in Virginia without slaves.
I had never even thought about that. I mean, I thought of, you know, freeing one's slaves being obviously the morally good thing to do. I realized there'd be some cost to it. I didn't realize that step one, free the slaves, step two, leave Virginia, because you simply cannot even survive here.
Right, and certainly a lot, I mean, there were farmers without slaves. I don't want to give the wrong impression, but a lot of people were saying that if you want to make a living as a farmer without slaves, you had to do it in the North.
Wow, yeah, certainly would have been a lot easier. Okay, so that's what Dolly Payne's father did when she was still just Dolly Payne. And then what happened?
Well, then they moved to Philadelphia, which was a very peculiar intermixture of both the largest Quaker community in all of the country, but within a city which was the most sophisticated and cosmopolitan city.
Mm-hmm.
So Dolly grew up within a society which was very strict in its morals and its manners and its mores, but within a society which was perhaps the most liberal and sophisticated.
The modern corollary might be this. New York City filled with, or with a significant population of Hasidic Jews.
It would be something like that.
Yeah. I mean, and they would have been sort of outsiders within this city, and there would have been, no doubt, some degree of friction, or at least, I don't know, alienation between the two, or separation at the
least. Right. And at least some question as to how your children are going to develop within this strange intermixture. Mm-hmm. Because Dolly's father clearly wanted his children to be raised in a very close-knit Quaker community. That was important to him. And yet what happened is that pretty much all of his children end up eventually leaving the faith.
Oh, boy.
Because they are, you know...
It's like Fiddler on the Roof. You know, everyone leaves the traditions behind. Okay, well, anyway, go on, please.
Right, so Dolly, in the first marriage, marries within the community. Her father had started a starch manufacturing business. And unfortunately, and this is again part of that economic story of the family's finances, of divesting themselves of wealth, going into a completely different form of business, and her father failing at that business.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Yes, so Dolly is...
Now he was really paying the price.
Yes, and this has to be told as part of the Dolly Payne Todd Madison story, mm-hmm. because that is one of the questions that gets asked. She is from a Quaker background, which is opposed to slavery, but she ends up marrying into a Virginia plantation family and herself becoming a slave owner as an adult.
Wow.
And one of the factors, I'm not saying this is everything, I mean, I think probably falling in love with James Madison had something to do with it, mm-hmm. but one of the factors of her acceptance of the institution must be that she suffered the pain of its reverse. She suffered the experience of living without slaves and going bankrupt.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about that, but you're exactly right. Now, again, I'm not defending slavery, but if anything's going to make you pro-slavery... It's having experienced what it cost you to give up your slaves and, in her father's case, everything.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if I recall, he was kicked out of the Quaker church.
That's right.
Wasn't he?
And we know that he went into debt and that was a part of the reason why he was read out of the Society of Friends. But many people think that there is probably something more to it, that the Quakers didn't merely read you out of the faith because you went bankrupt, that there might have been something else that was a little bit shady. There is a suggestion that maybe he traded on his good name as a Quaker in order to secure these debts. There is a question as to whether or not he succumbed to alcoholism. But some of this is conjecture. We don't know all the reasons. But he was read out of the regular Society of Friends, and he joined the Free Quakers, which was a subgroup of Quakers within Philadelphia that had supported the Revolutionary War.
The Fightin' Quakers.
Yes.
And probably the progenitors of the mascots of the University of Pennsylvania.
I suppose they have to be.
I'm guessing. I'm just guessing. At any rate, so they were the Fightin' Quakers, and they were sort of an offshoot group, right?
That's right. And I think there was one robust congregation there, and that's what he joined. They were a lot more loose in their rules of acceptance. And therefore, he moved into that community, but the rest of the family seemed not to. Dolly Madison married into the, they don't call it a church, but she married into the congregation that the family had been attending before,
okay.
The Pine Street Society. And that is where she presumably met, because he was a member, her husband, which was John Todd.
Who was John Todd?
John Todd was a young, promising lawyer mm-hmm. when she met him, and there is evidence that he hung out his shingle there in Philadelphia shortly after the marriage, and within a couple of years, they had the wherewithal to buy their own house.
And what a house it is. In fact, the reason I'm talking to you about this today is because I was in Philadelphia recently.
Do tell.
Oh, absolutely. I love Philadelphia. It's all kinds of cool stuff. It gave me several different episodes worth of audio. And among the many places I visited, I was looking for places I hadn't visited before. And I visited Todd House, which stands today, where is it? The corner of Walnut and Fourth. Right. I had a perfectly wonderful interview with a woman named Carrie D. Thorne.
Who is a woman well worth interviewing.
Indeed she is. And as I spoke to her, your name came up. And she was very complimentary of you and said, well, you know, Lynn was here. Why were you there? Why were you there? Tell us. What did you do?
Well, it is part of my researches because I portray Dolly Madison and because so many people have questions about her youth and her background and her development. I thought that it was important that I know the Philadelphia that she knew. And therefore, I went to Philadelphia in order to trace the steps of all the places that we could discern had been significant in her life when she lived there.
And obviously, Todd House, where she lived with John Todd, was among them. So let's talk about Todd House and finish the story. But let's not forget to come back to the fruits of your researches before we finish. But let's just leave that for the moment. Okay, so what's at Todd House today if one goes to visit?
Well, this is one of the really fortunate places that still exists. I mean, so much of what Dolly would have seen when she lived there is gone and replaced with an unrecognizable building. Mm-hmm. But Todd House, the basic structure, still exists. And unfortunately, I don't think any of the furnishings inside were original to the Todd household. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they have done a wonderful job of reproducing what it would have looked like just based on what other houses of the area and this class would have looked like. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you go there, you have the opportunity to experience what this middle-class existence would have looked like in Philadelphia and what she was surrounded with at the time of her first marriage. And at the time that her first husband died mm-hmm. of the
He died.
Yes.
Yellow fever.
Yellow fever. Mm-hmm. And therefore, this is also where the widow Todd lived mm-hmm. When she was introduced to the promising young congressman from Virginia, James Madison.
James Madison. And how did James Madison, how did that come about, I should ask? How did that meeting come about?
Well, it's another fortunate thing that it's a lovely story.
Oh, do tell.
Both Dolly Payne Todd and James Madison were acquainted with Aaron Burr, mm-hmm. which fortunately is a name that most people recognize.
Mm-hmm.
For Dolly, he had been a boarder in her mother's boarding house, which she opened in order to support the family after her husband went bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also an old college friend of James Madison.
Right, they'd both gone to Princeton.
Right, College of New Jersey at the time.
Right, Nassau Hall, right.
Okay. That's right. And so somehow James Madison had noticed the young widow throughout the streets of Philadelphia, and he asked for an introduction from Aaron Burr. And we have this existing letter that Dolly Madison wrote to her girlhood friend, Eliza Collins Lee.
So James sees Dolly on the street. Why didn't you say, hey, babe?
This was a different time.
Different time, okay. And he was not that sort of fellow. No doubt there were men at that time who would have done such things.
But they would have been scoundrels and rogues, and she would have nothing to do with
of
them.
Of course not. All right, so he seeks this introduction. So then what happened?
So he does it the proper way. Mm-hmm. He seeks an introduction, requests it. And we have this letter in which she writes to her friend, thou must come to see me. She speaks as a Quaker would have done, using the familiar second person pronoun.
Thou, right? Thous and these. They did speak that way, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. Thou must come to see me. The great little Madison has been asked to be introduced to me.
The great little Madison. Isn't that a marvelous description?
That is her phrase, yes. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the way that the story is told, she was there with her friend, and which was the proper thing to do, again, if you are going to entertain gentlemen callers.
Yeah, it might have been proper, but you know what? Young women do that today. Oh, he's really cute, but you can need to stay here with me. I don't want to go by myself. I need you to be here with me. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of these old rules of propriety had rational bases to mm-hmm. them, and I think this was one of them.
Yeah, okay. So she calls her girlfriend and says, come on over.
Right.
She sends her a text.
Right.
And so
she needs the, in addition to fulfilling the dictates of society at this time, she also is going to have another discerning judgment about this young man.
Oh, that's right. She wants to, oh, exactly. I want you to tell me what you think of this guy. Can't make up my own mind. Okay, go on.
And as the story is told, she wore her mulberry satin and a dainty bonnet on her head. And Aaron Burr brought over...
Wait a second, mulberry. You're talking about the color.
Yes, I am.
And forgive my ignorance. I do not know what color a mulberry is.
Oh, that would be a very deep purple.
A deep purple,
maybe a reddish
satin
purple.
Dress.
Yes.
Okay. All
so,
right.
Although she was a Quaker and disdained the finery of life, I think that it was said of her that she always loved this kind of finery and frippery.
I see. Finery and frippery. All right. So there she is in her finest and fripperiest. And what happened then? Did it go well? Apparently.
Well, I mean, her niece reports, and we're getting the story primarily from her niece's memoirs. And her niece reports that she captured the heart of this confirmed bachelor and recluse and bookworm immediately.
Wow. So she set a trap, and it sprang shut on James Madison's heart.
Well, that's quite a trap if she induced him to ask for the introduction.
Well, she was apparently just alluring as she walked down the street. This was a time when she was not in really good financial straits either.
Well, that is sometimes, I think, overestimated. Mm-hmm. Her husband left her in fairly good shape. Mm-hmm. She inherited not only all of his property, but half of his parents' property.
Well, because they had died, too.
Because they had died just before he did.
Right.
And if the order had been reversed, she would not have inherited it. But because her in-laws had predeceased her husband, she also stood to inherit their property. But there was some immediate financial difficulties because, unfortunately, her brother-in-law was something of a scoundrel and tried to do her out of the inheritance and dragged his feet. And therefore, she had to seek the help of friends of hers, and Dolly never lacked for gentlemen friends.
Right.
And
so this was just a stopgap measure. She just needed some help to get through the estate battle so that she could eventually get her money.
Right. And Aaron Burr, I know, helped her. There was another lawyer named Wilkinson, who was also in love with her, who helped her out.
She must have been something. Everybody's in love with Dolly.
Well, that is because she loves everybody.
Right. Well, that's what I've heard. That's what I've heard. In a good way.
We're
not casting aspersions.
Not
we're
at
giving
all.
Her a compliment. That's right.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Lynn Uzel, who is a scholar in residence at Montpelier and the resident interpreter of Dolly Madison. And we're talking all about Dolly before she was a Madison, which means, to a great extent, Dolly in Philadelphia. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Lynn Uzel. Stick around. Thank you.
All right, we're here at James Madison's Montpelier. Now we're not outside anymore. It's still a beautiful spring day, but we are inside at the Visitor Center, sitting in, I guess you'd call this, what, the snack bar?
Or kind
the
of our lunch snack bar area.
Lunch snack, yeah. Which is very nice, incidentally. And we've come across a lovely-looking family, all four members of it, mom, dad, and brother and sister. And we're going to ask them a question in a minute. But first of all, Kelly, hello.
Hello, how
good,
are you?
Oh, always very good. Do you have a hard question for this lovely family?
I always have a hard question.
Tremendous.
They're still smiling at us, though.
They're still smiling. Well, wait, they haven't heard the question yet. Okay, and who are you all?
I'm Patsy, Lexington, Kentucky.
From Lexington.
JD from Lexington.
I'm David from Lexington.
Rosie from Lexington.
Rosie from Lexington, too. All right, Kelly, what's this hard question?
All right, here we go. The term civic virtue means that the citizens, A, put the common good ahead of their own interests, B, put their own interests ahead of the common good, C, rule themselves, or D, limit the powers of government.
Oh, those are interesting questions. Okay, so we're looking for civic virtue.
Why is that important? What is civic virtue?
What are the answer choices again, Kelly?
A, put the common good ahead of their own interests.
What do you think of A?
I think it's A.
Everybody thinks it's A?
We do.
So far, okay. Even Rosalie? Or is it Rosie?
Rosie.
Rosie.
Rosemary.
Got it. Okay. We got that. Okay. Well, let's go through the others, though. Let's make sure. What's B?
B, put their own interests ahead of the common good.
What do you think of that one?
What do you think, Rosie?
No, that doesn't sound like a very good idea.
You don't like that one? Why did you like that, Rosie?
I just can tell.
Rosie can just tell. All right. What about C?
C. The term civic virtue means that citizens rule themselves.
What about citizens ruling themselves? Is that civic virtue?
That sounds more like republicanism to me, but...
Ooh, okay. Sounds knowledgeable, okay.
Nonpartisan
show. How about you?
I still think it's A.
Still thinks it's A, okay, because Rosie just knows. Okay, all right, and what about D?
D, civic virtue means that the citizens limit the powers of government.
What about that one?
I'm thinking that's constitutionalism.
Yeah.
So that's something else. It's not civic
something
virtue.
Something else. That's not civic virtue.
So you guys are going to stick with A?
Uh-huh.
Nothing I can do to convince you to change, huh?
Also, Dad knows a lot about this stuff.
Oh, that's why we're listening to Dad.
Dad is a ringer.
Now, Rosie is the favorite child.
Dad, what do you do that gives you this knowledge?
Dad's starting on a PhD in history, American history, this coming fall.
Okay,
so
you disqualified. All right, Dad's a ringer. Did he get it right?
They did get it right.
Hey,
civic virtue means that the common good is put ahead of their own interests.
Cool.
This is a very important constitutional concept. As you know, our framers, including James Madison, were very familiar with ancient history. And that was a concept that's mostly associated with the Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, George Washington was often considered to be the very embodiment of this concept. So civic virtue is the correct answer, and you got it for exactly the right reasons. And we're going to have to try to avoid these PhD candidates in the future. So here's your hat. Who gets it?
Rosie.
Rosie gets a hat? No, Rosie. No, they're pointing at each other. I'm going to give it to Rosie. And that's the first brother and sister I've ever seen sharing so eagerly. So
they are very good. We're very proud of them.
We
taught them about virtue, so.
They obviously are showing familial virtue here today. So I hope you all enjoy your visit to James Madison.
Thank you for your hospitality. We really enjoyed this trip so far.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Lynn Uzel, who is a resident scholar at Montpelier and who is also the chief interpreter of Dolly Madison. In fact, the only interpreter of Dolly Madison. And we're talking about Dolly's time in Philadelphia, a time before she'd met James Madison, a time when some pretty bad things happened to her. But then along came James.
Then what happens next is rather scandalous by the opinions of her friends, because within the Quaker tradition, one would wait a full year before remarrying after becoming widowed.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband had died in October of 1793. She met James sometime that spring of 94. And they were married the following September. There are some accounts that they met only in May, and she left by the end of May to travel in Virginia to see family. And he proposed sometime that summer, which means that they knew each other for a very, very short time before he proposed. And she accepted him sometime in that summer. We don't have that letter, but we have a letter from James Madison in August acknowledging the favor that she had done him by accepting his proposal.
So he proposed by mail?
We don't know that for sure. We don't know if he proposed before she left Philadelphia or if he proposed by mail. And I wish we did know that.
Yeah.
But
this is really fascinating because, of course, one can condemn such a quick turnaround, or one can say, look, they're both adults. They're both mature adults. Madison's, 43, 44, something like that? I mean, he's in his 40s at this time. She is only 25, right? But she's been married. I mean, she's a mature woman. She knows what marriage is. You get to a certain point, and you can tell pretty quickly, you know?
Right.
You can tell pretty quickly whether this person is going to be a good match or not. In fact, I know a lot of people who have been through divorces, who have been through widowhood, and, you know, they meet somebody, and pretty quickly they're engaged because they're now experienced in finding good matches.
Right. And what's interesting is that James Madison, in this instance, is acting the precipitous role. And we think of him as a retiring, reserved, bookish sort.
Right.
But he saw what he wanted, and he acted quickly. And
yeah, James. Go for it, Jim. Right.
And he acted on the most desirable object in Philadelphia. I mean, she had many suitors. And
you know what the moral of the story is? You know what the lesson here is?
Do tell.
That if you are a constitutional scholar of short stature, women can't resist you. And you can get the best girl in all the whole town.
Right, but you have to find...
I've always felt that.
You have to find the right woman.
The right woman.
I mean, remember that he had proposed to another young lady.
Oh, we'll skip over that.
Yes, yes.
She actually dumped him, right?
Yeah, she accepted him, and then she changed her mind.
Yeah, that was years earlier.
Years earlier, but it was the wrong woman.
Well, he obviously just had to wait for Dolly. I seem to also recall that that Madison had another supporter from the wings, and that was Mrs. Washington, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. There's another wonderful story. She knew Mrs. Washington for a couple of reasons. She was a distant relative, but probably even more so because her younger sister, Lucy, had eloped with George Washington's favorite nephew,
right.
George Steptoe Washington. And that's how she was acquainted with the Washingtons. And as the story goes, after she began keeping company with James Madison, Martha called her over to the president's house, and she arrived, and Martha immediately accosted her with, "Is it true what they have said, that thou art engaged to James Madison?" Again, we find the personal second-person pronoun. Martha Washington is not Quaker, but she is addressing Dolly in her own language. And
Dolly's probably thinking, oh man, she's going to get on me for marrying him too quickly, getting engaged too quickly. Is that what it was?
And, well, Dolly, first of all, was taken aback, and she stammered, "I think not." They had been introduced, they had perhaps been seen in society, but there was no engagement at this time, and she contradicted the First Lady. And Martha then came back with, "Well, if it is true, do not be ashamed, rather be proud. He will make thee a good husband. All the better that he is an older man. The general and I both approve of the match."
George Washington and Martha Washington were acting as James Madison's wingmen.
That's exactly right.
That's tremendous. And was also excusing Dolly from any opprobrium for doing it too quickly.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that, but maybe you're right. She had that preemptive support there. It may have made a difference. But of course, there's two issues there. The first one is that she's marrying before the full year is up since her first husband's death. The second issue is that James Madison is not a Quaker.
Uh-oh.
And by marrying outside the faith, she knows she is going to be read out, and she knows this because her younger sister, who eloped with George Steptoe Washington, had also been read out of the Society of Friends.
Oh, man. So what were her feelings on that subject?
Well, we can't know for sure because she never wrote about it directly. But there are indications that she was not sorry to leave the Society of Friends. She always had a great respect for it. And I think we can say that they did much for the positive aspects of her development. And what I'm thinking of is that, first of all, they treated women in a very respectful way. They had a much greater sense of the equality of the sexes. Her mother had been an elder in the church. The contributions of both men and women were very much valued in this society. And also, they were no respecter of persons. They had a great respect for every person on a basis of being in the image and likeness of God, rather than having any respect for titles or rank or hierarchy.
Very into equality.
Right. Elbridge Gerry, the vice president when her husband was president, once said that Dolly Madison presided at table with such ease that it was as if she had been born and educated at Versailles.
Wow, that's quite a compliment.
And it's quite a compliment for a young lady who spent all of her childhood in the backwoods of Virginia, and then her very young womanhood within the tight strictures of this Quaker family, which emphasized simplicity and, you know, shunned worldly things.
Yeah, you would expect her to be very socially insecure.
Right, but that's not the case at all. And I think that is because the Quaker tradition brings forward women, and also people sensed in Dolly... What Gerry had stressed was the ease that she had with which she conducted the table and interacted with people. And that is because she was comfortable and she treated every person as though they were special. And that's what they picked up on.
Yep. Then as now.
Right, well, let me tell you a little bit about the wedding.
Oh, by all means. Yes. I don't want to skip over the good part. All the women in the audience are saying, what do you mean? I want to hear about the flowers. Okay, let's get
started. All right. So she's visiting her family in Hanover County, which is north of Richmond. And he's with his family at Montpelier. Mm-hmm. And he gets the word that she has accepted him. And they meet at her sister's home, Mrs. Washington's home, in Harewood, which is in present-day West Virginia, which was at that
time. This is the wife of the, what was his name? George Steptoe Washington. So that's the Mrs. Washington's home they're meeting at.
Right.
There.
And so they meet there in September, and they get married on September 15th, which is the anniversary of James Madison Sr. So James Madison chooses the day that is going to honor his parents, who aren't there. And therefore, he gets married the same day that his parents does.
And this was at Harewood?
That's right.
Okay, and is that still in existence?
And it is still in existence, and it is still in the hands of the same family.
Really?
So,
and does it look anything like it used to look?
Looks very much the same. They did add on to it. Mm-hmm. But the core of the house is very much the same. And in fact, I had the privilege of visiting there. And the drawing room in which they were married is untouched since that day.
Wow.
They have not so much as put a coat of paint on it.
Wow. Talk about historical preservation. It looks exactly like... It looked the day that they got married.
Exactly. And in fact, if you look on my website, you will find a picture of James and Dolly as they are portrayed today, standing at the mantle where they would have gotten married.
You mentioned the W word. You mentioned the website. I've been holding off on discussing that because I want to end with it. But let's go ahead and do it. I mean, we've now talked about Molly. We've now talked about Dolly before she was a Madison. Now she is a Madison. So we're more or less at the conclusion of our focus today. So let's now talk about your website and how you've memorialized all your researches and how people can share them with you. Go ahead, please.
Well, other people have mentioned to me that my website is very different from some of the other websites you might find of people advertising their services as historical interpreters. And I think that's because I approach it from the same perspective as I do all my scholarship, which is my purpose is to be a form of education for those who visit it can learn a lot about Dolly Madison and her world. And therefore, I have one page which is devoted to a short biography of Dolly Madison, and another page which is devoted to portraying Dolly Madison's world. Mm-hmm. And in this page, I try to highlight all of the places where she has lived and show what these places would have looked like while she lived there. And that was my project while I was in Philadelphia.
Right. So you've got pictures of all these places we've discussed. Mm-hmm. You even got pictures of the sites of some of these places that are no longer there. You have pictures of the buildings that are there now. So at least people who want to can go and stand and look at the site, even though they're looking at something else.
Right. And if someone wanted to do a historical tour of Dolly Madison's Philadelphia, I have on the website a map of Philadelphia that was done in 1776. But labeled on the map are all the places which were significant to Dolly Madison.
And I should have known, and I should have called you before I went to Philadelphia. I knew I was going to see Todd House. And, of course, I know your connection to all of this, but for some reason it just didn't click that I should call you. If I had, then I would have known more before I went.
You would have had all the sites labeled and laid out for you.
And one of them that I completely was unaware of that's on your website was Dr. Physics House.
Oh, yeah, yes.
And apparently that's open, and I could have gone, and I didn't go, so I paid the price for not looking at your website. What is this Dr. Physics House?
Oh, it's very interesting. Well, first I'll tell you the part that I knew before I went to Philadelphia, and then I'll tell you about the part that I learned. So what I knew was that much later, after Dolly Payne Todd became Mrs. Madison and was living in Washington, she developed a knee ailment. And in order to treat it, it became quite serious. It's some kind of ulcerated problem on her knee. Mm. She went to the most eminent physician in the country, which was back in Philadelphia, and which was Dr. Philip Singh Physic. Isn't that a great name?
That is a fantastic, it's like a TV show name. I'm Dr. Physic. Okay.
And Dr. Physic was able to doctor her up. She stayed in Harper's Ferry, which was a few miles away, which is interesting. I don't know exactly why she chose to stay there. But she was still the social center while she was there of Philadelphia. And Dr. Physic treated her. And the only thing that was unpleasant about the visit was that it took much longer than he had predicted, and she ended up staying there for months. And she went there with James, but he eventually had to go back to Washington. He was Secretary of State. He had obligations.
And he's got stuff to do.
Stuff to do. And this is one of the very few times in their lives after they were married that they were separated. Huh. And so it was very painful for them, but it is such a treasure for posterity because these are the few letters we have between James and Dolly Madison.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that the historical record gets better when the couples are separated?
Right, and that's
they had to correspond.
Right, and that's why we have all these great letters between Abigail and John Adams,
right,
because they were apart half their marriage. But between Dolly and James Madison, and they had such a special marriage, but we don't get that insider's view of it because they were always together.
That makes sense. Well, Dr. Physics House is apparently open as well. One can go visit.
That's right. It's very interesting. And so I knew about that connection between Dr. Physic and Dolly. But what I found out while I was visiting the house was that Dr. Philip Singh Physic had been a very good friend of John Todd, her first husband.
Oh, another connection.
They had been boyhood friends, and John Todd's father had been a schoolmaster, and Dr. Physic had been a student under the elder Todd.
Todd Sr.
Yes, and
small world.
Small world.
I mean, and that really makes sense. I mean, there were far fewer people in the country then, and, you know, an even smaller proportion of them were in the upper classes, the educated classes, the professional classes. So it makes, I mean, everybody knew everybody else.
Right.
And knew of them.
And the Todd house is only a couple of blocks away from the Physic house.
And I didn't go because
I didn't
look at your website. What is the website? How do people find it?
In order to find the website, go to www.dolly, don't forget the E in Dolly.
Right. P-O-L-L-E-Y.
Right. P as in pain, Madison.
So dollypmadison.com.
DollyPMadison.com,
Dolly with an E, and they will then go to your site.
And then one of the pages on that site is Dolly's World.
And that's the one I've been spending actually just earlier today going over. It is well worth a visit. I enjoyed it immensely. It's got a lot of nifty pictures, maps, love the maps. And if you are at all interested in Dolly Madison and you are going to be anywhere near Philadelphia, that could be your guidebook.
Absolutely. Especially if you want to focus on nothing but Dolly Madison.
You could do it. It could be all Dolly all the time. This would be a day or two of walking around and touring.
Yeah, it took me more than one day, but that's because I had to learn things as I went. But I think
that's what we all want to do.
That's right.
But I've done the
work for you.
Okay, the last question.
All right.
When you did your walk, going to the places Dolly went, did you do it in costume?
That'll be the next trip.
Oh. Lynn Uzel, thanks so very much for coming on your Weekly Constitutional again.
Stuart, as always, it was a pleasure.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. After the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then a special treat, a visit to Todd House in Philadelphia, personally guided by Carrie Dethorn of the National Park Service. Stick around for this one.
Sean O'Brien, what is happening this week at Montpelier?
This week at Montpelier is a gorgeous, hot August week.
Uh-huh.
And it is definitely worth coming. We have, of course, our Big Woods. And I know you've walked in the Big Woods.
Yeah, I've walked in the Big Woods. It's nice and cool in the Big Woods.
It's nice and cool and shady in the Big Woods. And so come to Montpelier in the summertime, in the hot weather, and walk in the woods. Also, unlike James Madison's time, the mansion is air-conditioned.
That is tremendous, and I think it's an enormous improvement over Madison's time.
It is an enormous improvement.
Very important.
He would have probably been much more comfortable in his black clothing in an air-conditioned mansion.
Indeed he would. But you were talking about walking the trails, and, you know, old fat guys like me, we walk the trails, but you are a not-so-old, very fit fellow, and I understand that you are a biking dude.
I am a little bit of a bike enthusiast. I do
bike
both biking and mountain biking.
Now, I want to hear then about biking Montpelier.
There's a great 23-mile loop that you can do starting at the Montpelier train station, so right outside the entrance to Montpelier. Very often, I will go and Kat Imhoff, our president, will go on a nice little loop at the end of the day, and you go out into some of the countryside of Orange County. And you just can't believe it when you come around some of these corners. And you know exactly why James Madison lives where he lives.
It's gorgeous.
Because I
have never seen countryside as beautiful as the Virginia Piedmont.
I was on this ride with somebody the other day who had never been on it. And we came around one of the corners and she said, I don't know why people go to France to ride bikes.
Why?
It's gorgeous right here.
It's because, you know, they're French too.
Well, yes.
Yeah, exactly. We're Americans. But anyway, here we are in America.
James Madison wrote to Thomas Jefferson in France. I think they both actually like the French quite a bit.
Yeah, the French are okay. They got good wine. Okay, but at any rate, we're talking about Montpelier. You're biking, and this is a great place to bike. In fact, even if one only stayed on the Montpelier grounds,
yes,
there are plenty of roads, there are plenty of paved paths, mm-hmm. there are plenty of relatively rough unpaved paths for the mountain biking types. So people could just come and bike at Montpelier. In fact,
Absolutely.
It doesn't cost you anything to bike at Montpelier because you can come in for free.
That's correct. Come onto the property for free and walk around, have a picnic in our gardens, play a little frisbee, ride your bike around the property. My kids have had a good time riding around the property over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I think one of your kids is with us here today. And she's making noise here. So, Eileen, have you been biking at Montpelier?
I biked once at Montpelier with one of my friends who...
Did you break anything?
No.
You didn't
break
anything.
Break
okay,
anything.
Very good. Okay.
Unusual, but here we are.
You had a good time.
Yeah.
So even...
But in the gardens, there's this... bushes, they have a tunnel through them, and you can go straight through the bushes in the gardens.
On your bike?
No.
Oh, not at, okay. Well, you could if
this
you had a mountain.
It's more
bike.
Of a hands and knees kind of activity.
Oh, okay. I understand. So they're cool things for 13-year-olds to do. And so any weekend at Montpelier is a good weekend to go.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Sean, and thank you, Eileen.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking about Dolly before she was a Madison. Thus far, we've spoken with Lynn Uzel, and she's given us the outlines, the basic facts of the tale. But now let's go to Philadelphia. Let's go to where Dolly lived before she was a Madison, and let's speak with Carrie D. Thorne, a historian for the National Park Service, who was kind enough to open up Todd House in Philadelphia for me and to give me a personal guided tour, despite the fact that Todd House is technically closed because of the federal budget sequestration. So thanks a lot, Carrie. Here's our interview.
Here at the Todd House, we talk about the Todd's daily lives. We talk about what happened to Dolly next. But more than anything, we talk about how life in this house was a series of choices and a series of decisions. A devastating crisis happened to the family who lived here in 1793. And through understanding their response to that crisis, we get a much better picture of what the 18th century was really like. And yes, Dolly became Dolly Madison and is a very famous person in American history. And that's part of the reason why the Park Service added this property to Independence National Historical Park. But it's only part of it. Another part of it is it allows us to tell that story of Philadelphians in the capital city, professional people who are what are really building the new nation. And that's really why the Todd House is part of Independence Park. It's not just that she became a famous person. And here at Independence Park, we're very interested in our visitors seeing these great men and great events through the lens of the majority of Philadelphians and the majority of Americans who never signed the Declaration of Independence or who never voted for president, but are contemporaries of those people. And so that's really the purpose of it. And the house has been restored and refurnished, although we have nothing here that belonged to the Todds because nothing survives that we know of, except for John Todd's law docket, which is in the other room in his law office. The objects that you see here are all 18th century objects from the same time period as the Todd's occupancy, and they're very carefully selected to reflect the Todd's taste and socioeconomic standing. So here in the kitchen, of course, they use an open hearth, so you see a lot of vessels for stewing and baking things. The next room here is their parlor, what we would sort of call their every room or their kind of living room, if you will. And probably Dolly spent most of her day in this space when she wasn't bathing the kids or cleaning the house or something like that. And we have it set up to kind of show some school lessons that Dolly might have been going over with her teenage sister, who lived with them sometimes and helped out with the babies. This isn't an ostentatious room, but it's a very comfortable room, carpet on the floors, and it's meant to convey the socioeconomic status that the Todds had. And it might be a little understated, but it's still very colorful. And that's where you get this idea that, you know, Quakers talk about plainness, but it's not literal plainness. That really doesn't happen until the 19th century when American Quakerism undergoes a significant philosophical change.
That's a very pleasant room.
Yeah, very. And you walk right through it from the kitchen, through the parlor, into John Todd's law office. So the front door is the door right here. So right. His clients come into this little hallway, and they come into the law office, which has his library. Now, we don't know what books he had in his library. We just know that when he died, his estate listed books. They were among the most important or most valuable thing on his estate list. And we've recreated it based on various titles. There are certainly some Quaker titles here, but there's geography, there's history, there's mathematics, philosophy. The law office docket is the book there on the desk with the big ink stain on the front of it. Mm-hmm. This would have been Isaac Heston's area, this law clerk desk right here. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things we've tried to do with the Todd House is when you go to a historic house and it's been restored and refurnished to reflect a certain period of time, what the historic site is trying to do is we're not trying to recreate the past. That's not possible, of course. All we're trying to do is simulate some aspects of it to create a context to help visitors identify with the lives of the people that we're talking about. So many beautiful objects, many fine historic antiques, but that's not really the focus of our program here at Independence. The focus of our program at Independence in the Todd House is the Todds, the people. But what we have tried to do is we have tried to present the house with this concept of the summer of 1793 and the yellow fever epidemic. So you'll start to notice here on the first floor, and you'll notice it much more when we go up to the second floor, we've done some sort of things that might catch your eye and might seem strange. For example, on the wall over there, we have a framed map, but it's actually covered by a very gauzy fabric, sort of somewhat obscuring it. And you're like, well, what is that? And what that represents is, in the 18th century, whether it was fever or not, in the summertime, there's no such thing as window screens in 18th century America because the technology to develop drawn wire hasn't been invented yet. So if it's hot, you have to open the windows. And if you open the windows, every insect in the world flies in.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the 18th century, what you did was you covered your mirrors, your picture frames, as much as you could with this gauzy fabric to keep flies from lighting on the reflective surface. They are attracted to that and depositing waste. So we're trying to reflect how the Todds might have lived in the summer, and we've wrapped all the looking glasses or mirrors and framed pictures with glass in this gauzy material to kind of represent that housekeeping trick of the 18th century.
I see. Very interesting.
We also have some references to the yellow fever. If you look on the up at the wall there near the ceiling, you'll see those that green clump of vegetation.
Right.
It's not real vegetation. It's artificial. But what it represents is a common technique for trapping flies.
Oh, really? It's
and
a fly
what
trap.
You, what you did was you got an asparagus fern, and
uh-huh.
asparagus ferns have very frothy fronds. And the insects fly in, and the fronds are sticky, and they can't fly out again. So you put these bundles up around, and the flies, you're going to catch some of them. You're not going to catch all of them, probably not even the majority of them, but you will catch some of them. So you'll see around inside the Todd house here these bunches of simulated asparagus fern that are meant to reflect the experience of 18th century people trying to live through a hot Philadelphia summer without window screens. Over here on the clerk's desk, you'll see at the back of it a yellow dish that has this coil of what looks like rope or cigar. And it actually is a coil of reproduction tobacco because, as we were discussing earlier, the 18th century theory of medicine based on four humors and how to dispel illness was to keep off miasmas. You can run away from it, or you can smoke on a stogie and create a lot of smoke around your head and drive off the miasma. The good thing is you also keep off the mosquitoes if you do
that. I was thinking.
But they wouldn't know that.
They wouldn't know that, but that's kind of funny because on occasion when I've been out in the woods, somebody will offer me a cigar. And it's about the only time I ever imbibe.
And it really does work.
It works. It keeps the bugs away from
it. Really does.
It really does.
So
it makes you smell bad, too.
Yeah. One of the ways in the 18th century of dealing with yellow fever was to burn smelly things, like tobacco.
Right.
And so that dish of tobacco there means that, you know, we're sort of referring to the yellow fever remedy.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So let's take a walk up to the second floor.
Sure.
Where the family has additional spaces.
Here we are on the second floor.
We're on the second floor, and the Todds have something that was fairly common in Philadelphia among people of the middling sort, and that's a second parlor for entertaining, and that's where we are now. This room is directly over John Todd's law office, and set up for tea. You can see the tea set out. You'll see, again, that idea of the mirrors.
That is really striking, this one here especially, the mirror covered with gauze, because you really can't... Can you even look in it? I mean, can you...
Well,
really?
The other thing we should remember about looking glasses is they're not just for examining whether your hair is straight.
Right.
In the 18th century, they're for reflecting light. Because if you have candlelight...
Oh.
The more reflective surfaces you have, it's going to bounce light around, and that's going to raise the illumination level.
I've never, ever thought of that. Of course it is. They're just light reflectors. They're just a way...
Well, oftentimes you'll see in an 18th century restored house a looking glass hanging very high over the mantelpiece, so high that you'd have to be 10 feet tall to look into it. And
yes.
On either side of it will be candelabra, and that's the purpose, is to bounce light into the room. So...
That's a very illuminating observation. Okay.
Well, I'm glad I could put some clarity in it for you.
Indeed, you did.
So we have here another desk, probably the one that Dolly would have used, On the table, we have a facsimile of the letter that John Todd writes to a client in October 1793, just before he dies. The historic letter is part of our collection, but we don't display the historic letter because paper is very susceptible to light damage, and so we create a facsimile. So we'll walk down the hall here on the second floor, and this small space, which is over in the first floor parlor, would have been used as a bedchamber, but what we're illustrating here is Dolly packing up to leave.
Of course.
So she's packing her trunk, the bed's unmade, and the covers are off, and the mattress has been turned over for air. She's mending some of John Todd's trousers. So this room is really meant to kind of reflect the preparations for getting ready to leave the house, leaving her husband behind at his direction, to take her children to a safer place. And if we step down here, where we'll be is a small room over the kitchen. And in the 18th century, this kind of room is often called the kitchen chamber. And this is probably where Dolly Payne Todd's sisters, who occasionally one of them would stay with her, help her with the housework and the kids, would stay in this room because it has direct access to the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So she can get down there, stoke the fire in the morning without disturbing the rest of the family. More evidence of packing you can see here on the bed and on the desk.
Now, none of this is original, so I'm guessing you'd be very pleased if someone were to contact you and say they thought they had original Todd piece.
Well, we would certainly follow up on it, no question. And that happens to us all the time, not just about the Todd house, but about all of our properties, Independence Hall, et cetera.
How should people contact you if they think they have something?
Well, they can call me directly. They can email me.
What's your email address?
My email address is the same as my name. So it's K-A-R-I-E. Then there's an underlined blank space and my last name, D-I-E-T-H-O-R-N, at NPS, or National Park Service, NPS.gov.
Good.
So it's Carrie_Dethorn@NPS.gov.
So if anybody thinks they have a Todd artifact, that's where they should...
They're welcome to contact me.
Okay, good.
They could also, of course, contact Montpelier and talk to them about it.
Well, of course.
We were in pretty regular contact, Montpelier and Independence, because we share a story.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, I have a very good friend there, Meg Kennedy, I understand you work with. And so you're both on your detective hunts.
Exactly. Well, we're always on the lookout for things that have a story associated with our site, and as is every historic site in the United States. I mean, things that survive from the past are so few and so precious to us, and they tell us so much about the people that live with the things, that we want to preserve them as much as we can, and we want to make them available to the public if it's at all possible. So.
Okay.
Now, above us is the third floor where we have two additional bedrooms, the one that Dolly and John probably shared, and then one for the two boys. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty typical bedrooms.
Right.
And so when visitors come to the house, they see it with the park ranger, takes them on tour. And it's actually a companion tour with one of our other historic house museums. So hopefully the Todd House will reopen this fall, after the federal government makes new decisions about our budget. And once again, the public can see where Dolly Todd Payne and soon, or Dolly Payne Todd and soon to be Madison got her start.
Tremendous. Does that pretty much complete our tour then? Well, Carrie Dethorn of the National Park Service, we are so grateful to you. This has been a fascinating tour through the Todd House in Philadelphia, and we encourage everyone to come here and visit you after the sequestration has been resolved. And thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Wasn't that just great? Thanks so much to Carrie Dethorn of the National Park Service, and thanks also to Lynn Uzel of Montpelier. I just enjoy the heck out of talking about Dolly Madison. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.